Okay, let's turn to Acts chapter 27. Acts 27. Remember that in Paul's defense before Festus, he was forced to claim his right as a Roman citizen to appeal his case before the emperor. We had that back in chapter 25 in verse 7, where it says, after Paul arrived, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many and serious charges against him, which they could not prove. Well, Paul said in his own defense, I have committed no offense, either against the law of the Jews or against the temple or against Caesar. But Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, answered Paul and said, are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and stand trial before me on these charges? But Paul said, I am standing before Caesar's tribunal, where I ought to be tried. I have done no wrong to the Jews, as you also very well know. If then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything worthy of death, I do not refuse to die. But if none of those things is true which these men accuse me, no one can hand me over to them. I appeal to Caesar. Now, Paul was kind of backed into a corner here because, of course, Festus wanted to take him down to Jerusalem and the Jews wanted to kill him. And he thought his best chance would be to make his appeal to Caesar. Now, that determines the course of events for the rest of the book of Acts, because the rest of the book of Acts now will be Paul's journey down to Rome. And remember, Paul has been tried before three Roman officials now, and they couldn't just let Paul go because he was out in the, well, it was the leader of the Jews was extremely upset with Paul. In fact, the whole Sanhedrin was extremely upset. It would cause very hard feelings between the Jews and the Romans if they just let Paul go. On the other hand, Paul was a Roman citizen. And he deserved the rights that the Roman citizens had. They couldn't deny him due process. So they have no alternative now, since he has appealed to Caesar, but to send him to Rome. So things kind of turned out the way they had to, really, because everybody was kind of pushed into a corner by the Jews who were just in a fury over Paul. So that leads us then to the last section of the book of Acts, and that'll be chapter 27 and 28, Paul's trip down to Rome. And first, we'll have the beginning of the journey in chapter 27, and then we'll have a delay after the shipwreck in chapter 28, 1 through 10, and then the completion of the journey in 28, 11 to 31. So those three sections are the last three sections of the book of Acts that we only started it, what, a year and a half ago? So we're really bombing on through this book, and that'll finish it out then. So as the journey begins, first Paul is going to make it to Crete via Myra, a town called Myra, and we'll see how that happens. Just as a introduction to this section, I'm going to read a quote in the commentary by F.F. Bruce on this section. And this is the sea voyage section, the section that's going to take them through the shipwreck after they leave, or after they get to Crete. And they'll have a shipwreck, and it'll be very much a seafaring type of a section. And F.F. Bruce says about this section, and that'll be chapter 27, Luke's narrative of the voyage and shipwreck of Paul is a small classic in its own right, as a graphic, a piece of descriptive writing, as anything in the Bible. It is besides one of the most instructive documents for the knowledge of ancient seamanship. So we're coming upon this section that's a very classical type of writing. Remember, Luke was the physician. He was a very well-educated man, and he's writing this account. And some commentators go to the point of saying, well, you know, this writing is so classical in its style. It's such a great story. It probably didn't really happen, and it's just an allegory of life. And you'll see a lot of commentators say that. And the main reason they say that is because it's not really super spiritual. I mean, it talks about going from here to there. It talks about a shipwreck. And they say, well, you know, this is just an allegory. We have to look for a deeper meaning in these verses. Well, first a note, there's nothing in the context that indicates that this is anything other than just an account of the facts. And in the second place, I think we can learn a lot about spirituality from this section by looking at how Paul handles himself in this situation. We're going to find out a lot about Paul, and we'll find out in a situation after we get, starting next week, basically, when the shipwreck takes place, that Paul was a very, very practical, down-to-earth kind of guy. And we'll see that tonight even, too, as he argues against taking off in bad weather. And we'll find that Paul is a practical man. He keeps his head in the face of an emergency. And we can learn about spiritual things from how he, a mature Christian, reacts to them. So that's how we'll take this account in chapter 27. We'll take it as a factual account that Luke has written down. So let's look at the travelers. Who's going to be on this trip with Paul? First, Paul, of course. And then we'll have Luke here. In 27, verse 1, it says, when it was decided that we would sail for Italy. Remember, Luke is writing this book, so when he says we, it's what we call one of the we portions of the book of Acts. He's along with Paul. So Luke is here. Now, we haven't seen him. Look back at 21:25. We haven't seen him for a while. In fact, it's been over 2 years since we've seen Luke. Back in chapter 21, in verse 15 is following, he's there when it says, after these days, we got ready and started on our way up to Jerusalem. So there we have Luke in the picture, and he goes up to Jerusalem with Paul. But as Paul is taken down to Caesarea, he's imprisoned for 2 years. We don't hear anything about Luke again. Well, now Luke is back in the picture in chapter 27, verse 1. We have another we section. Luke possibly allowed to go with Paul, as Paul's a prisoner, obviously. He's going to be taken by a Roman centurion down to Rome. And Luke is allowed to go with him, possibly as his physician. Remember, Luke was a physician. There's Aristarchus also with him. Aristarchus was a believer from Thessalonica, remember. He was with Paul down at Ephesus when the riot broke out down there. Look back at chapter 19, where we saw him before. In verse 28, the crowd is mad because Paul is proclaiming the gospel. In verse 28, it says, when they heard this, they were filled with rage. They began crying out, saying, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. And the city was filled with confusion, and they rushed with one accord into the theater, dragging along Gaius and Aristarchus, Paul's traveling companions from Macedonia. Remember, Macedonia is where Thessalonica was located. It's in northern Greece. So we have the same guy here, Aristarchus the Thessalonian. That's down in verse 2. It says, in embarking in an Andromitian ship, which was about to sail the regions along the coast of Asia, we put out to sea, accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica. So we have him along. Ramsey, who wrote one of the best commentaries ever on this book, explains Luke and Aristarchus being allowed to go along with Paul as his slaves. He said they posed as his slaves so that he would be allowed to take them. Now, that would kind of explain how Paul is treated on this trip, because he's treated very well, as we'll see. The Roman centurion is very good to Paul, and, of course, having slaves would be a matter of respect. Now, who knows if that's true? That's just what one guy theorized. But we have some other prisoners that are going along. chapter 27, verse 1, when it was decided that we should sail for Italy, they proceeded to deliver Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. So we have other prisoners, their names, how many, we don't know, just some other prisoners going along. And then there was Julius. Now Julius, it says, was a centurion of the Augustan cohort. Now remember, a centurion was a Roman officer in the Roman army who was in charge of 100 men. That's why you get the centurion title. Now the Augustan cohort was a special unit in the Roman army. They weren't attached to another division. This 100 man cohort, or this cohort, was what we might call a special forces unit, maybe a delta force. They were the elite of the Roman army. And they were often assigned to special duty like this, police duty, taking a prisoner from here to there. So this Julius, he was probably a rough guy and a very good soldier, because he was in an elite unit, and it was his job to take Paul and the other prisoners down to Rome. Now they catch a ship. In verse 2, it says, "And embarking in an Andromitian ship, which was about to sail the regions along the coast of Asia." Now the ship is designated by its home port, and that's Andromitium. Here's a map, and I'll show you where Andromitium is. It's up here. You can see it. These are the seven churches of Revelation plus. This is Asia Minor over here, and here's Ephesus. There's Corinth and Athens. Andromitia was a main thoroughfare between Asia and Europe, as a matter of fact. They would travel back and forth. The ship was what was called a coasting vessel. It says in verse 2, embarking in an Andromitian ship, which was about to sail the regions along the coast of Asia. We put out to sea. So it was sailing the regions along the coast. Now, a coasting vessel, what that means is that it would make stops along the coast. It hugged the coastline and made stops along the way. Now, if you were a railroader, you would probably call this a local rather than an express, because it stopped at all the little whistle-stop towns along the way. So it was one that stopped and it worked its way around the coast. Now, it's probably making its way back home for the winter, because the winter's coming up, as we'll see later on this evening. So this ship heading home for winter, and it'd be stopping along the coast. Paul and his companions hop on, and they're going to travel over 500 miles in this ship. At Myra, and we'll see where that is in a moment, they're going to change ships and then head for Rome. And we know that we'll find out next time they run into trouble down in Crete. But that's kind of an overview. That's the ship they catch. So they start out their trip, verse 3 through 8. Let's read those. Starting at verse 3, it says, "The next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul with consideration and allowed him to go to his friends and receive care. From there we put out to sea and sailed under the shelter of Cyprus, because the winds were contrary. When we had sailed through the sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed at Myra in Lycia. There the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy, and he put us aboard it. When we had sailed slowly for a good many days and with difficulty had arrived off Cnidus, since the wind did not permit us to go further, we sailed under the shelter of Crete off Salmone. And with difficulty sailing past it, we came to a place called Fair Havens, which is near the city of Lycia." So the first leg of the journey then is going to be from their embarkation point, which isn't mentioned here, but I take it it's Caesarea, probably Caesarea, down to Sidon. Now that takes us just up the coast a ways, in fact about 70 miles north. Now this map doesn't show their stop at Sidon, but as we have it in the text, they stopped over there. So we're heading from, this is Jerusalem, where it's, this whole thing started, down to Caesarea, up to Sidon. See, they go up around Cyprus that way, and they end up over at Myra here in Asia Minor. So Sidon, just up the coast, about 70 miles. At Sidon, Paul is shown his first consideration by the Roman centurion. Julius gives him every consideration on this trip, and it even says so. It says in verse 3, the next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul with consideration and allowed him to go to his friends and receive care. Now that word consideration is an interesting word simply because you'll all recognize it when I tell it to you. It's the word philanthropos. Philanthropos. It's from the word philanthropos. What's philanthropos? Philanthropy. We get that word from it. It means literally love of mankind. So he showed respect, philanthropy towards Paul. And we find that throughout the New Testament, centurions are actually portrayed in a very favorable light. I take it that in order to be a Roman centurion, you had to be kind of an honorable guy. You had to be a good guy, because we see that throughout the New Testament. Remember Cornelius? Remember back in Acts chapter 10? Look back in Acts 10. Cornelius becomes, his house becomes the first Gentile believers. Remember when Peter was proclaiming the gospel? Back in chapter 10 and verse 1, it says, "Now there was a man at Caesarea named Cornelius, a centurion of what was called the Italian cohort." So he was the centurion of the Italian cohort, portrayed in this story in a very favorable light. He calls Peter down, and Peter proclaims the gospel to his household. Back in Matthew, look at Matthew chapter 8. Just an example of what kind of guys these centurions were. Matthew chapter 8 and verse 5, where it says, "And when Jesus entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, imploring him, and saying, 'Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, fearfully tormented.' Jesus said to him, 'I will come and heal him.' But the centurion said, 'Lord, I am not worthy for you to come under my roof, but just say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to this one, go, and he goes. And to another, come, and he comes. And to my slave, do this, and he does it.' Now when Jesus heard this, he marveled and said to those who were following, 'Truly I say to you, I have not found such great faith with anyone in Israel.'" So again, a Roman centurion portrayed in a very favorable way in the Bible. And that's, go back to Acts 26 now. That's just a little side issue or side note I wanted to bring up. The church at Sidon, stop at Acts 11 on your way back to Acts 27. The church at Sidon, and Sidon is in an area that's called Phoenicia, and it's here along the coast and around that area. It probably was established following the death of Stephen. Now remember when Stephen was killed, there was a great persecution, and the persecution scattered the believers out. Like I've heard one illustration of like hitting mercury with a hammer. They just flew everywhere. And one of the places they went was an area called Phoenicia. In chapter 11, in verse 19, it says, "So then those who were scattered because of the persecution that occurred in connection with Stephen made their way to Phoenicia and Cyprus and Antioch, speaking to the word to no one except to Jews alone. But there some of them, men of Cyprus and Cyrene, who came to Antioch and began speaking to the Greeks also." Remember, the headquarters of the church will actually move from Jerusalem up to Antioch after this point, but that's when the churches were being established in this area. So probably Sidon was one of those churches that was established. And Paul is allowed to visit the church down there. The centurion shows him consideration, and he allows him to go to his friends and receive care. Now, undoubtedly, he was accompanied by a soldier, but he was allowed a certain latitude in his imprisonment. Again, remember, he was a Roman citizen. He had certain rights. Now, from Sidon, they head on to Myra. In verse 4 and 5, it says, "From there we put out to sea and sailed under the shelter of Cyprus, because the winds were contrary. And when we had sailed through the sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed at Myra in Lycia." So now on to Myra. Here's the map again. And notice it says they sailed under the shelter of Cyprus. That means they're going on the leeward side of Cyprus, or the side away from the wind. They were protecting themselves from the wind because it says the winds were contrary. The winds, and I got this off a modern website, they're called the Etesian winds at this time of year, and the prevailing winds would be from the northwest. And this is how they went. Up here in the Aegean, they started down south and then took a left here and around the coast. So the winds prevailing at that time of year would bend directly against them. Remember, they're traveling this way. They want to go that way. So they're going basically against the wind. So that's why they went behind Cyprus, so to speak. The ship hugged the shoreline. It says we had sailed through the sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia. So they're hugging the coast so they could take advantage of local winds. Now, those would be the prevailing winds, but there might be a local wind going the other way. And there was a westward current there. So if they hugged the coast, they could take advantage of that current and not be blown backwards, which would be a bad thing in a ship to go backwards. So that's what they're doing here. And that's why it says we sailed under the shelter of Cyprus. That's why it says that. Now at Myra, when they get to Myra, the first part of their trip comes to an end. They're going to change ships here. Myra was a major port for ships that moved grain from Egypt to Rome. It was one of the major stopping off places. Remember, Egypt was one of the, well, it was the chief granary of Rome. That's where they got the major portion of their grain, and there was very heavy traffic, so to speak, between Egypt and Rome. So a ship of that grain fleet apparently was anchored at Myra. Look down at verse 20 or 38 of chapter 27. This is when they're in the storm or the typhoon. In verse 38, it says, "When they had eaten enough, they began to lighten the ship by throwing out the wheat into the sea." So they're carrying grain. It's apparently one of these grain ships that travels between Egypt and Rome. From there, they head over to Fair Havens, verse 6 through 8. Reading at verse 6, it says, "There the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy, and he put us aboard it. When we had sailed slowly for a good many days, and with difficulty had arrived off Cnidus, since the wind did not permit us to go further, we sailed under the shelter of Crete off Salmone. And with difficulty, sailing past it, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lycia." So now we're going to head from Myra to Fair Havens. First, up the coast to Cnidus. That's Cnidus, right? Or Cnidus, right there on the tip of where the coastline turns there. So they're heading up the coast again on a different ship now. Here's Alexandria down here, by the way, in Egypt. And you can see that Myra is almost straight north, so it's a good hop for those grain ships to head up to Myra. Then normally they would head due west over to Cytherea, that little island right here, and then over to Rome. But we see that their journey is going to take a different jaunt here, and we'll see why in a minute. It took many days to go from Myra to Cnidus, verse 7 says, when we had sailed slowly for a good many days and with difficulty had arrived off Cnidus. Again, remember, they're fighting those winds that are coming down the Aegean and hugging the coast here. So they're fighting the prevailing winds. Now here, the protection from the Aetesian winds was done. They didn't have any more protection. Now, if they went straight west, they would be right in the path of those Aetesian winds. So they're going to try something else. They're going to try a kind of an end run here. Once they reached Cnidus, they had two choices. There were two things they could do. They could put into port and wait until they got a fair wind. Actually, Cnidus was a very good port. It had two harbors, and they had good accommodations there. And with a fair wind, then they could head straight west to Cytherea, like as they normally did. The other choice was they could make a run for the tip of Crete here and go for the protection against the winds that they could get by going this way. So they could make a run for the eastern extremity there of Crete. So those were their choices. They could either wait or try this end run deal. They couldn't go straight because the winds were bad. So they decided to make the run for Crete and pass on the downwind side, again the leeward side, just like they did at Cyprus, trying to use the island for protection against those winds that were heading south there. And this brought them to Salmone. That's Salmone, if you can't see it on the map, Lacia, and then to Fair Havens. That's Fair Havens is right here, very close to Lacia. And that's their first really convenient shelter on Crete. So they put in there, and they waited for the wind to change. So now they're waiting for a fair wind. And in verse 9 through 12, the trip becomes dangerous. Verse 9 says, when considerable time had passed, and the voyage was now dangerous, since even the fast was already over, Paul began to admonish them and said to them, men, I perceive that the voyage will certainly be with damage and great loss, not only of the cargo of the ship, but also of our lives. But the centurion was more persuaded by the pilot and the captain of the ship than by what was being said by Paul. Because the harbor was not suitable for wintering, the majority reached a decision to put out to sea from there if somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, facing southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. So the trip now has become dangerous. And the reason that is because the dangerous season for sailing ran from September 15th to November 11th. So from September 15th. Or 14th, I have 15th down here, one of those two, September 14th or 15th, let's say the middle of September through November 11th. That'll be the dangerous, what they call the dangerous season. Now, after November 11th, they shut down the shipping lanes. They wouldn't sail in the open sea after that in the winter. So we're getting down to the dangerous portion of the sailing season. After November 11th, the next time they could set sail would be at the very earliest, the beginning of February. So we're talking about a pretty big layover here. So they left Fair Havens about mid-October, and I say that because the fast that Luke is talking about in verse 9, it says, when considerable time had passed and the voyage was now dangerous, since even the fast was already over, and I have a marginal note in my New American Standard Bible that says the Day of Atonement, and we take it to be the year 59, the Day of Atonement on the year 59 fell on October 5th. So it was after October 5th, apparently. That's right in the middle of the dangerous sailing season. What happens is Paul warns them against traveling in this dangerous time of the year. In verse 10, he says, and said to them, men, I perceive that the voyage will certainly be with damage and great loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives. Now, this is a very unusual verse from a couple of different standpoints. The first standpoint is, why was Paul giving them advice when he was a prisoner on the ship? Why would they go to him for advice? I take it that they had a ship's council, and since Paul was an experienced traveler, I mean, he'd been around, you know, that they ask him for his opinion there, which is kind of unusual. They call a prisoner in and say, you know, you've been around a lot. Can we have your opinion too? He advised them to stay at Fairhaven, and he advised them at the peril of their own lives, and not only theirs, but his. Notice down at verse 10 in the last part, he says, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives. So that's the second thing that's very fascinating about this verse. And why is that significant? Well, remember back in chapter 23, in verse 11, when Paul was being encouraged by the Lord, it says, but on the night immediately following, the Lord stood at his side and said, take courage, for as you have solemnly witnessed to my cause at Jerusalem, so you must witness at Rome also. Gee, God promised Paul he was going to make it to Rome. Now here's Paul telling them they better not head out in this dangerous water, or they could all get killed, himself included. Didn't Paul trust the Lord? Well, this is one of those passages that gives us a balance between God's sovereignty and man's responsibility. Notice Paul doesn't see any contradiction at all. You know, how many people spend hours and hours and hours and years trying to figure this out? The balance between God's sovereignty, man's responsibility. God is sovereign, right? He's going to make things turn out the way he wants them to turn out in the end, isn't he? Well, then why should I do anything? Why should I even worry about it? Well, here's Paul, who was promised specifically that he was going to make it to Rome. And yet here's he's advising this ship not to set sail in dangerous waters because they could all be killed. Now, this is what we call an antinomy. An antinomy is basically, I don't know, in scholarly terms, our little pea brains just can't figure it out. We can't handle it because there are two things that appear to be contradictory, and yet they're both true. Is God sovereign? Of course God's sovereign. Is man responsible? There are imperatives throughout the New Testament. How do you balance those two? Well, it's something we can't balance logically. Remember, man's intellect is fallen. Now, some people tend to forget this. They think, well, yeah, my will is fallen because I'm a fallen man, but my intellect isn't. And that's a big movement among the philosophers, that man's will is fallen, but his intellect isn't. I can still noodle this stuff out if I just think hard enough about it. But the fact is, man is a fallen creature in all of his aspects. So we can't understand things like this. But to Paul, it was no contradiction at all. He had been promised by God that he would stand in Rome, yet he was less of a risk taker than the captain of the ship. In fact, in verse 9, when it says, when considerable time had passed, down at the end of the verse, it said, Paul began to admonish them. And that, you notice the began isn't really in the Greek text. The word admonish in the Greek is an imperfect tense. And what that an imperfect tense signifies is that it was continuous action in the past. So we could say Paul admonished them again and again and again. He kept on admonishing them. So it wasn't just something he said once. It was he kept telling them, you guys, we shouldn't do this. We could all be killed. Well, notice very interestingly as the story unfolds here that Paul, who's a prisoner, remember, He's a prisoner on the ship. He becomes the leading figure on the ship as we get to the story, and we'll get to that next week when they hit the storm. Paul is going to be the guy who kind of keeps his head and keeps things in line. Now we go on in verse 11 and talk about the pilot and the captain's opinion. Verse 11 says, but the centurion was more persuaded by the pilot and the captain of the ship. Now, just by way of explanation, the pilot of a ship was the guy who was responsible for safe navigation, and it was also his job to discipline the crew. That was his job. Safe navigation, discipline the crew. The captain, normally in those days, was the owner of the ship. On a merchant ship like this, the ship owner normally acted as the captain of his own ship. Now, this guy would have been under contract from the Roman government to deliver grain from Egypt up to Rome. So therefore, you could kind of consider this a government ship because he was under contract to the government of Rome. And the reason I point that out is because you notice the centurion has the final say in it. It says the centurion was more persuaded by the pilot and captain. Another note, the pilot and the captain or owner of the ship might have been the same guy. It would be like saying the commander in chief, the pilot and captain. He could have been the same individual. But the final decision wasn't left in his hands. It was left to the centurion. Why? He was the highest ranking Roman official on board the ship. Since they were under contract to the Roman government, he would be the ranking official on board. Now, he was responsible then for the soldiers, the prisoners, and the wheat. So it was his job to make sure that ship made it down to Rome. Now, he was more swayed by the pilot and the owner of the ship, and possibly more swayed because he didn't want to be embarrassed in Rome for delaying the grain by being timid about taking off in this weather. So hard to tell, but anyway, he was more swayed by the ones who wanted to head out. So the result is they left Fair Havens, verse 12, because the harbor was not suitable for wintering. The majority reached a decision to put out to sea from there if somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete facing southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. So they wanted to head on down to Crete, and the result is they leave Fair Havens kind of what you might say on a wing and a prayer, because they're heading in very dangerous seas now, in very dangerous time of year to be sailing. And notice, they don't want to go all that far. Here's Phoenix here. Here's Fair Havens here. They don't want to go that far, but it's so dangerous that time of year that Paul advised them, we better not do that. And we'll find out next time. They hit a big storm when they leave Fair Havens. So next time we'll pick up there with verse 13 and we'll read the story of the shipwreck and go through that. I'm sure you've read through this many times before, and pick up with verse 13 next week. Father, thank you for your word and thank you for your book of Acts, this historical account of what happened to Paul on his way down to Rome. In Christ's name, amen.